pulling back the curtain of silence
and learning what freedom feels like. I'm Nick.
And I'm Lala. This is Seen, Brown-Eyed Activism.
Healing at the intersections.
I'd like to begin by offering a content note. This episode contains discussions of sexual violence and rape culture. And I'd like to take that a step farther by talking a little bit about what therapists call the window of tolerance. This is the window within which our system is able to handle what's happening without going into fight, flight, or freeze mode. And despite what we might hear when people mock trigger warnings or use the word triggered as a pejorative, this isn't about avoiding discomfort. Trauma survivors handle huge amounts of distress and pain all the time. But when we're in fight, flight, or freeze mode, we're not really able to learn, grow, and heal because our system is too busy trying to survive. Some signs that you might be outside of the window of tolerance include dizziness, nausea, numbness, feeling like you're being transported somewhere else in time and space, feeling like the feelings are bigger than you are. If these things are happening, you might choose to take a break and do some grounding. That might look like standing up and taking a few steps, trying to balance on one leg, tapping your arms and your legs, doing something repetitive like coloring or knitting, counting backwards from 100 by threes, throwing a ball, calling a trusted friend, or anything else that gets you back into the here and now. Or you might not choose to do any of those things. We're survivors, and I want to honor all of the many ways that we find to survive on our own terms. So now Nicole and I are going to dive into this conversation, and we're going to take our own advice and stay in touch with our bodies while we talk to make sure we're within our own windows of tolerance. So Nick, how are you feeling right now?
I don't know. I'm a little bit nervous.
Yeah.
I don't think that I'm not scared to talk about this.
Yeah.
I think it's like the first time that I have intentionally created something. One of the first times, that's a lie. One of the first times that I've intentionally created something that really tries to talk through these things. And I feel like I don't talk about my sexual assault or sexual assault in this like very personal way that often.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, I don't really know what to expect from myself almost.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
How are you feeling?
A little bit nervous, but definitely wanting to go there. Like, it's stuff I've been thinking about for a long time and wanting to talk about.
Yeah.
I'm really ready to have a conversation.
Yeah. And thanks for that content warning. The stuff that you just said about how do we take care of ourselves?
Yeah.
You know, how do we ground ourselves? How do we respect what our body's telling us?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think no matter where you stand with respect to your proximity to this, it can be really heavy.
Absolutely.
And so it's really good for us to be kind to ourselves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like putting on your own oxygen mask first. It's you have to take
care
of.
Don't save the babies, save yourself.
Yeah. You got to take care of yourself first because you need to be in the right space in order to engage with anybody else or really like be productive, whether it's doing your own healing or learning from somebody else or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
So it's interesting when you said this is one of the first times you've created
one of
a space.
The first times.
Yeah.
But
not
like
the
with
first time.
Yes, but like one of. Yeah.
Yeah. Because so in the many, many hours of conversation that we've had, we realized when we were in pre-production for this episode that we've actually never really talked about this in depth before.
Yeah, no, we haven't.
We haven't.
And my initial thought about why we haven't had many conversations, explicit conversations, really direct conversations about us being survivors, because it's an identity we both share, in addition to being women of color, being queer. But it's like, it is a big part of the journeys that we've taken and where we are right now.
Yeah.
And I thought at first that the reason that we hadn't talked about it is because I feel so comfortable with you that I almost assume we shared the same politics, and from having conversations and being your friend, I was just, I'm aware of the fact that you get it.
Yeah.
So I guess from my perspective, I always felt like we didn't have to talk about those things because there's so many other things like music or Beyonce or, which is, you know, she's more than music. Okay. That's why it's separate from music.
Yes.
which is, yeah, that's kind of my take, but yeah, what do you think? Like, why do you think we didn't?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we also have talked a lot about, for example, racism. And we know that each other gets it, but we've still talked about it. And so I felt like maybe it had more to do with the way our culture is. Like, we're so used to not being able to talk about it. We're so used to keeping it to ourselves.
Yeah.
And I also think sometimes when we have really traumatic experiences that overwhelm our systems. They don't get kind of processed and integrated into us in the same way as experiences that are more manageable,
yeah,
that are more inside our window of tolerance.
Yeah, yeah.
And so then it becomes this sort of like separate thing that isn't woven into the story of our lives in the same way that other experiences are.
You know, it's kind of funny that you said it like that, because I never, the conversation of me identifying as a survivor seldom comes up.
Yeah.
And it seldom feels like a natural pulling into people. And people ask, like, oh, well, tell me about yourself. I'll say, you know, I'm passionate about these things, these things, these things. And I might say, you know, if somebody asked me, like, where did you volunteer? Like, what are your philanthropic things that you care about, or what issues mm-hmm. matter to you? I would definitely say the dismantling of rape culture and ending all violence, but specifically gender-based and sexualized violence, because I'm a survivor, but I probably stop there. The window of tolerance might not even just be for us. I think it's what we think other people feel is comfortable for them. And it's difficult to know how to integrate that conversation into any other conversation with people in a way that doesn't, I don't know, like totally disarm yourself.
Yeah.
You know, you feel very vulnerable when you're sharing something like this.
Absolutely. And I know I've definitely had lots of people over the years who, when they find out I'm a survivor, when I say I'm a survivor, they say, oh, you can talk to me about that anytime. Mm. And then when I have tried to say more, they shut down.
Yeah.
Or, you know, they just don't seem to be able to give me empathy in the way that I need it, or they seem overwhelmed by it. Mm-hmm. And so I've kind of learned that a lot of people, even if they say you can talk about it, really you can't.
Yeah. Yeah. And that lends to what feels like a forced silence about it, you know, that people aren't going to get it. And if you even start talking about it, that no one's going to care.
Yeah.
You know, and we're going to talk about that.
Yeah. So how did you feel when Me Too went viral? It was about a year and a half ago that it really took off.
I felt a couple of things. I felt affirmed in some ways. I felt
affirmed, like how?
I felt affirmed because it was the first time where I saw so many people. So specifically, I found out about Me Too through being on Facebook.
Yeah.
And seeing so many women that I know post like personal stories of how Me Too resonates with them or how they're connected to it, it just made me say, holy fucking shit. Like, this is so much bigger than us and so much bigger than me. And I guess there was some sense of solidarity that emerged for me and feeling like, wow, there's so many people that get it.
Mm-hmm.
But then at the same time, I went onto Facebook and I definitely posted something to the effect of, this has been really triggering for me. Yeah. Take care of yourselves. Because I felt like I had to chime in and say, me too. You know, there's, especially because of things like social media, is this moment where FOMO really sets in. And so when you see other people doing certain things and it resonates with you, you feel like you have to say something as well. And that is literally no disrespect to anyone who posted, because I also, like I'm saying, I posted something, but I felt compelled to. I felt like I had to.
Right.
And that made me feel awkward. And then I just wanted to disassociate from social media.
Yeah.
But I was super fortunate to have friends who checked up on me. And that was because I made that post. That's the thing, right? Like, I don't know if they would have checked up on me knowing, you know, the friends who know, if I didn't make that post.
Yeah.
So, yeah. How did you feel like when Me Too was like in your face?
At first, I felt nothing. Like, I just felt a block. I felt nothing. And then I was actually listening to a song that's very about defending your boundaries and men trying to take advantage of you and defending yourself against that. And it unblocked something in me, and I started to feel so angry.
Mm.
And I actually went home and I also posted. And what I said was, you know, all of my love and support to all the people who are posting, because I wanted to honor the power and the choice that they made to participate in that way.
Mm.
But I just felt so fucking angry because I already knew, I've known for so long that like most people have experienced sexual violence, and in particular, the vast majority of women have experienced sexual violence. I already knew that, and I'd been trying for so long to talk about it and running into all of these people who don't listen or don't care. And so then to see all of these survivors ripping their heart open on social media and people saying, oh, I'm going to do something different, you know, in response, I just thought, fuck you. No, you're not. Because we've been saying this.
Yeah.
It's been happening all around you. It's happened to your friends and you ignore it. And it's happened in your family and you ignore it and you make excuses for it. Mm-hmm. And so don't pretend now that this is somehow changing something. How is anything different?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so I literally posted this message saying, like, fuck you to everybody who has let this drop out of their minds every time it passes in the news cycle and who has found an excuse to not believe a survivor. All of those things, I just couldn't deal with it. I was so mad.
Yeah. No, I fully understand that. I think it was incredibly triggering for me. And I think it's interesting that you said you've always known, or you've known this for such a long time, you know, the epidemic that is sexualized violence. And in fact, for myself, I have known for so long, even at the time where I was experiencing violence, I was fully volunteering at a rape crisis center.
Yeah.
And I think it was that experience that made me aware of the pandemic that this is.
Yeah.
But I think even then, it didn't feel, it still felt so it still felt so individualized for some reason. I didn't, and it was, that was at a time when I was understanding these statistics and getting really like fucking mad about it. But I think there was something really validating in seeing all this out there and seeing how so many survivors were so willing to put their experiences out there. And I think for me, I saw that as a way of showing I'm not going to be silent about this anymore.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's so powerful. And I think that is probably one of the most important parts of me too, is all of the survivors who have been empowered to feel like they can speak about it and like they don't have to be silent and they don't have to gaslight themselves anymore about it.
What does gaslighting mean again?
Gaslighting is basically when you try to convince someone that they're crazy, that like their sense of reality is not correct.
Right.
And so gaslighting yourself is sort of making yourself feel like you can't trust your own feelings and you can't trust your own reality. And of course, we gaslight ourselves because everybody around us gaslights us. And then those voices stay in our head.
Right.
When they stop talking, it just continues in our head.
Yeah.
So I don't want to take away from the importance of that aspect of the movement and all of the amazing work that Tarana Burke, the Black woman who originally started the Me Too movement back in 2005, way before it went viral. So much amazing work is being done. But I think for me, seeing so many survivors ripping their heart open all over social media, another thing that I posted about at the time was saying, if all of the men and non-survivors who were at the time commenting and posting about, I'm going to take responsibility for my complicity, or all the people who were saying nothing,
gave a fuck?
Yeah. And if all of the non-survivors spent 1/1000th of like the time and the energy and the money that I and other survivors have spent trying to heal from this and trying to change something and trying to spread the word about it, our world would be very, very different. And I just feel so sick and tired of survivors not only being asked to survive this horrific violence, but then to be the ones always leading and always doing the hard work for everybody.
Mm-hmm. One of the reasons why going on Facebook was super triggering was because I got really, really mad and disappointed at the lack of seeing any men that I knew posting about Me Too. And that's interesting that you had seen folks say something to the effect of, I too will be a better man or whatever. What does that even fucking mean, first of all? And we'll talk about that in a second. But I found for my quote unquote Facebook friends, so many dudes were posting about like whatever sports game was going on at the time. And I was like, how can you do this? I felt a lot of heartbreak. That's what I felt. I felt really betrayed and I felt a lot of heartbreak. And I felt like this is the reason why I have unfriended so many people on Facebook, because like, of course you don't give a fuck. And I just continued to be like, that sigh.
Yeah. And don't get me wrong, the vast majority of the men on my Facebook were silent. But then there were a few who posted trying to take responsibility for their complicity. And then it was just really frustrating because the number of likes and comments that they got, and so many people, and, you know, and a lot of women just falling all over themselves to be like, oh my God, thank you so much. Like, you're so amazing. And I mean, I get it. I get it that we're so used to people not showing up that if they do even the bare minimum, you can feel really grateful for it sometimes. But it was just so frustrating.
Yeah, it kind of feels like we're thankful for crumbs.
Yeah. And I just want to be really clear too that people of all genders experience sexual violence.
Yeah.
And people of all genders perpetrate sexual violence.
Yes.
But the reason that we are talking about men's role in it is because we live in a culture where men have systemic power.
Yes.
And where there are a lot of cultural ideas that lead to the overwhelming majority of perpetrators being men.
Exactly.
And so that's why we were talking specifically about men, but people of all genders are survivors and perpetrators, and it's really important for us to say explicitly that.
Yeah, no, for sure. Me Too kind of came out at the same time that Time's Up was happening. And there were these conversations that were happening at a bigger level. And I think it elevated conversations that we need to be having. But I always am skeptical about, or I guess I have a lot of, I don't know what the word might be. It might be bitterness when I see all of that attention and all of that focus on people who are largely people you don't talk to, but largely people you don't even interact with. And there's like such little focus on the people that are around you that are experiencing that violence, or that have told you they've experienced that violence.
Yeah.
And I feel like there's some sort of cognitive dissonance that happens where when you see like, oh my God, I love that celebrity, I can't believe that happened to her. But it's like, okay, but your friend or your cousin or, you know, your girlfriend or whoever else, or whoever, it doesn't matter. I'm not trying to ascribe a specific gender to this, but I always want to say like, keep that same energy and give it to the people in your life that you have not supported or not taken the opportunity to listen to when they've tried to talk to you about their experience, or the friends of yours that you know are perpetrators and you're like, yeah, that's really fucked up, I want to be a better person. And it's like, I always am like, start with what is immediately around you.
Yeah, but you know? I think that there's a very specific reason that people don't, and I think that the closer it is to home, the harder it is for people to face. You know, I remember when I first started confronting sexual violence, I was quite young. I was 19. I had been sexually assaulted recently, and it happened to me before as well. And it had happened to my best friend as well. And we were starting to sort through it. And it honestly, it tore my entire world apart.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel like I was living in the same world anymore. All the world views that I had about how things were and what our culture was and how people treated each other and how the world worked. Everything was shattered.
And we talked about this, like, there is almost a before and after.
There is a before and after.
There is a before and after where you're totally right. The things you thought, the things that for me that I took for granted,
yeah,
I became like super ultra heightened and aware about. For me, I've experienced sexualized violence a few times, but like the one time that it was, I guess, the quote unquote worst time, the one that imprints in my memory and that will never kind of leave me, I think my like initial response, as I said, I was like volunteering at a rape crisis center at the time of my assault. Not like volunteering when it was happening, but like, you know, at that point in my life, I was volunteering. Looking back at it, I powered through that experience so quickly. I didn't even want to sit with it. And I wanted so badly to like take off my skin and just like not be in my body anymore. I felt like, and I told you this before, like I had felt like my body betrayed me. I had felt like, you know, I couldn't even trust myself. Yeah. I didn't know if I could trust myself, you know? And there's nothing quite like, there's nothing in my mind that really compares to feeling unsafe in your own body.
No, there isn't.
So
how does it feel to remember that?
It's a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, you know, I didn't seek any kind of formal support after my assault.
Yeah.
I was still on the crisis line.
Wow.
I was still on the crisis line. And then it got to a point where my volunteer coordinator was like, hey, you know, some of your shifts, you've been like dropping calls. Like, what's been going on? And I'm like, I can't do this. I actually am not in a place to be supporting other people because I'm so close to this. And it's like, I thought I was close to it before.
Yeah.
And then it was like, this is my life now.
Yeah.
And so I ended up transitioning to do more educational outreach. But even thinking about that, I didn't take a moment or a pause. I literally went from supporting survivors to being a survivor to being a survivor and continuing to support survivors. Like there was no breaks.
Yeah.
And to your point about it's always us that has to do this work. I can't say that enough. It always seems to be us that has to do this work. And I guess on one hand, like we're so close to it, we understand it. But it's like, for fuck's sake, we could use the help.
It can't all be on us.
It can't.
We can't change the entire world by ourselves. And it's not fair to ask us to survive and then to do everyone else's work for them.
Yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit about how things have changed or not changed since Me Too. But first, I want to check in. How are you feeling in your body?
I was feeling activated.
Yeah.
And we were like locking. We were sitting like facing each other right now. And we're just like locking eyes. But I'm feeling okay. I'm feeling grounded. How are you?
I'm feeling good. I'm taking some deep, slow breaths to remind my body that everything's okay. That's if you're able to take a deep, slow breath to do that, it really helps your system to know that things are okay.
Yeah.
So let's just do some tapping for grounding. So this is a good way to ground when breathing sometimes is a little inaccessible when we really need it because our inner body sensations are not always something we want to connect with in the moment.
Mm.
So just tapping your legs, just up and down your legs and tapping up and down your arms. It can just help kind of bring you back. Remind your body we're here, we're in the now, and right. We're safe and everything's okay. How does that feel?
Much better.
Yeah.
But like also shit's heavy.
Yeah. So you can keep talking, but keep checking in
yes.
and keep grounding.
Yeah.
I'll ask you, do you think anything has changed for survivors since Me Too went viral in 2017?
Do I think anything's changed? No.
Yeah.
I really don't think anything's changed. For me, change would look like us being able to have these conversations outside of this room freely and people around us to be able to be like, that's really fucked up and I can't believe it happened to you. That, to me, is what change should look like.
Mm.
And currently, I'm still so fearful of talking about my assault the way that we're doing.
Yeah.
Largely because I've just gotten to a place where I truly believe that it wasn't my fault.
Mm.
So nothing's changed, and I feel, you know how in the beginning of this episode you were talking about how this word triggered has been kind of co-opted sometimes and seen as a pejorative. I feel like that's just a testament to the fact that shit's not changed, because leave it to dominant culture to find something that hurts so many of us so fucking deeply and make it something funny.
Yeah.
Or attempt to make it something funny, because that shit's not fucking funny.
Yeah.
You know?
I know so many survivors that I know, like, we don't want to use the word triggered, even though it has a very specific meaning for in post-traumatic stress, where, again, it's not about – it doesn't mean discomfort. We're very practiced in dealing with discomfort.
Yeah.
It's getting into this fight or flight. And when you have post-traumatic stress, your body often will get stuck in that. So for me, if something was very triggering for me, when I was really going through it, when I was at my worst, when something would really trigger me, it might mean that I could barely eat for, like, weeks.
Right.
Or it might mean that my chronic pain got so bad that I couldn't work. Or it might mean that – you know, I started having a lot of nightmares or panic attacks where I just have panic attacks all night and think I was dying like the entire night.
Mm-hmm.
That's what triggered is,
mm-hmm.
or that's the consequences of being triggered. It's not oh, this is an uncomfortable feeling for me, which is what a lot of people have started to use it for. And especially a lot of people want to push back on trigger warnings or want to push back on accommodations for people who experience something as triggering, because they think it just means
you're uncomfortable, yeah, or you don't like it.
And they think, oh, well, it's important to be uncomfortable.
Motherfuckers, we know it's important to feel uncomfortable. You want to know what it feels like feeling, you know, racism, yeah, and sexism, you know, like all these, yeah, things, all these isms. Like, uncomfort is something that we can definitely handle and manage. We've both been on this earth for 11 years already, yeah, so I think we're fine with that. But how do you feel, or do you feel that anything's changed?
Again, I don't want to say that nothing has changed, because I do want to honor the work of people like Tarana Burke and other advocates who I know are making changes in their pockets of the world. But for me, as a survivor personally, nothing has changed. And I think for me, what I would want to see change, sort of what you're saying, so there's a lot more people maybe now saying that they're survivors, mm-hmm, publicly. And yeah, that's big. And I don't want to take away from that, especially for the people who have more recently found the language to understand what happened to them. That's, mm-hmm, so important.
Yeah, that's, and I agree. I totally agree.
And I think what's really frustrating for me as somebody who has been speaking about this for a long time, there's always a lot that you can't say. So you can say you're a survivor sometimes. You can say you've been sexually assaulted sometimes. But I remember ever since it happened to me, I remember whenever anyone was talking about sexual assault, whether they were using that language or not, I'd be listening so carefully to hear if they were victim blaming in a certain way. If they were saying, oh, but, you know, she was drinking, or, oh, but can we really know? Whatever they might be saying, I was listening to hear, would they blame me if they heard my story? Mm. And, oh, they said this specific thing meant that this person wasn't believable. That means they wouldn't believe me, right?
Totally.
And so I learned, I collected all of those, and I learned what parts of my story were more likely to be believed and what weren't. Mm-hmm. And so there is, you know, the time when I was 19 when somebody sexually assaulted me while I was sleeping. If I just say that, I know that most people will say, oh my God, that's so awful, and they'll see me as a real survivor. But I know that if I were to say, you know, that sexual assault isn't something that's just happened to me once or twice or three times, or if I were to tell the entire story, or if I were to tell a different story of a different occasion where it happened, I know that I wouldn't be believed, or I wouldn't be seen as sympathetic.
Yeah.
There's so many aspects of our stories as survivors that we know we can only say to our therapist or maybe to our best friend. Yeah. And for a lot of people, not even that.
Yeah.
There's so many things that survivors will take to their graves.
100%.
Because they're so ashamed, and they think, well, this part means that it really was my fault. Totally. Or I'm not a real victim.
When you're saying that, honestly, that's... it resonates so much for me.
Yeah.
I was assaulted on my birthday. Mm. Like 7 years ago. And yeah, it was one of those, like, you know, it was my birthday. I was like definitely drinking, but
yeah,
I never, and do I tell people that I was definitely drinking on my birthday? No, I just say it happened on my birthday. Yeah. And I think you're totally right. I believe that so many of us base our stories of surviving, of victimhood, on whether or not other people will continue to victimize us or not, because we're already doing it. You know, we're already doing it to ourselves. And like you said, you would listen to how other people would be responding to others sharing their experience. And that was how you like gauged whether or not you were safe to share all the details or some of the details. Other times that I've been assaulted, I don't even bring those up. Because it's like the not as bad time. Like, exactly. It was like, oh, it was bad datey, but it wasn't this, or it was this and it wasn't that. And it's like the fact that we feel like we have to do that. You know, people saying things like, oh, was it rape or was it rape? You know, like, I mean.
Nonsensical.
I mean, does that even make sense? Is that something that we don't deserve that, mm-hmm, you know?
Yeah. So a big moment in the movement and a big moment that defines how I feel about the movement as a whole is when a woman who's she went by Grace, published a story about when she was sexually assaulted by Aziz Ansari. Mm-hmm. And I don't usually click on those things. I don't usually click on the detailed accounts. But for whatever reason, I did. And I read the whole thing. And I just remember thinking, wow, that's so real. Like, I just didn't have any doubt that it was true because it was just so real in all of its details. And I just felt stunned by her courage because I thought, those are the kinds of stories, those are the ones I don't tell. Those are the ones I keep to myself because I know that people would just say, oh, come on now, that's not really sexual assault. Why don't you just leave? Why don't you just say no? Of course, she did say no many times in many different ways, and she did try to leave, and he systematically would try to calm her down and then raise the level of coercion or violence that he was using. And this is how he managed to overwhelm her and sexually assault her. But yeah, I just was really in awe of the fact that she was willing to say that publicly. And of course, that was the beginning of the backlash to the Me Too movement. That was when people started saying,
Has the Me Too movement gone so far?
Hasn't it gone too far?
You know, aren't men's lives being ruined so much? I think, to your point, I read that story as well. It was almost the, like, mundaneness and the, like, just it seemed so regular of a story. And the responses that many women who went on to say that wasn't really sexual assault simultaneously also said, well, that happened to me and that wasn't sexual assault. And it's like, but it was sexual assault. It happened to you.
There was a tweet at the time saying women defending Aziz Ansari by saying, if that's sexual assault, then every woman I know has been sexually assaulted are so close to getting the point.
So close, but so far.
Yeah.
And still doing so much harm.
Yeah. And that, I mean, for me, that was the first time that I felt overwhelmed by what was happening. I remember that backlash starting and I posted something about it saying how upset I was about the reaction to the story and people trying to defend Aziz Ansari and blame Grace. And all these people showed up in my comments, people I'm supposedly friends with showed up in the comments saying, oh, but I mean, he shouldn't have done that, but I don't think that's really sexual assault. And I want everyone to know that that legally is sexual assault. Even legally it is.
Yes.
But I also don't care about the law. She was harmed by that.
And that's what matters. Yeah.
And that's what should be, that's what we should care about.
Yeah.
And that was when I got really triggered and I like had trouble eating and I went to work and I forgot my keys and I was in a panic because I had a client. Like that was when it really started to overwhelm me because that's when it became so clear that as much as people want to say that things are changing, people still aren't ready to believe survivors.
Mm-hmm.
People aren't ready to look at harm and care more about the harm than what they might lose by having to acknowledge the harm.
Thank you for saying that. There was this incident with my favorite bae of all time, Amanda Seales, where she was on her podcast and she had spoken a couple of times about an individual who had come at her like, you know, we should go on a date or whatever, and something to the effect of, I really want to see you, I want to spend time with you, all this sort of stuff. And then she had spoken about this on her podcast and had actually women who knew who she was talking about without her naming him come into her mentions and say, like, I know who you're talking about. Is it this person? And it was that person, right? Oh. And so after being overwhelmed by like 7-8 women who had said, this person that you're speaking about, he was pushy for you, but for me, you know, we went on a date, our first date, he invited me to his house, he opened the door and he was naked. And I found that to be really, really, really fucked up.
Yeah.
And she went out and publicly named this person.
Wow.
And the backlash that she received was, you've harmed him so much. He is a neurosurgeon. How dare you come at him? You really hate black men. You must be so bitter. You must have been a scorned lover. Like all of these things. And her response, she's bae because she has so much integrity. But for her, she said, I couldn't in good conscience have this information in front of me and not say anything. When you were saying we need to care more about the harm, we need to care more about the harm. There was harm done. Whether or not he thought it was a joke to open the door naked, whether or not he thought it was funny, whether or not he thought it was appropriate or not, that doesn't fucking matter. Because now there are women who are experiencing post-traumatic stress after having been sexually harassed, because that is sexual harassment. And yeah. That matters. We should care about that.
Yeah. What about the harm to their lives?
Exactly.
And also I would ask, what is it that made him think that that was funny or that that was okay, if that really is what he thought? And I mean, I doubt that it was a joke. I think it was more violent than
Absolutely.
A joke. But let's give him all let's of give the, him benefit the benefit of the doubt.
Sure.
Best case scenario.
He thought it was funny.
Why was he allowed to think that? What enabled him to think about, to see it as a joke and not have any awareness of how it would impact the woman in front of him?
I think it speaks to the level at which a lot of men don't care for or don't understand what is important to women and femmes and non-binary folks. That's what I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you as a man don't know why doing something like that would be harmful, you have no business being in the company of other people.
Yeah, and there's been so much information available for so long that I have to just think that they don't care.
Exactly.
That they're more interested in maintaining the system where what they want and their power and their ability to take whatever it is that they want by whatever means they have to get it, that is more important to them than the safety, the well-being, and really the lives of the people around them, in particular the women and non-binary folks around them. So that's why, you know, moving forward, when I try to think about what would I like to change, I mean, I almost can't even say anything around perpetrators because I have so much cynicism and so little hope about their willingness to change.
Yeah. I have so little hope about their willingness to change, and yet I find myself having done so much work on myself that I know that I'm changing, and that we're changing, and that we are changing the world around us.
Right.
But again, it comes back to us having to do that work. And that's the only thing that I can rely on, is us doing that work. I can count on survivors doing that work, actually. In fact, I can really count on survivors doing that work, because those are the only people that have done the work.
Yeah. I'm sick of survivors being asked to do everybody's work for them. But then I really am a lot more interested in the question of what can we do for ourselves?
Yeah.
If we stop trying to change the people who are not willing to change, if we stop trying to change people's minds, convince them to get on board,
mm-hmm.
and we directed all of that energy to ourselves and to the other survivors around us who are doing the work, what could we do?
Totally.
Like, what would that mean? What could we, how could things change? What would it mean to really show up for ourselves?
Mm-hmm. I have a story.
Yes.
I have a story that I think is a pretty good story.
I need you to tell the story.
I wrote no notes, so I'm going to freestyle it, but I've told it a few times. In fact, let me say that I definitely had a Christmas party and had, like, all my close friends gather round. Like, it was story time, and I was like, y'all need to hear this motherfucking story.
Yes.
And so gather round.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm so excited.
Get cozy. So our mutual friend, Daniela, and another mutual, actually both our mutual friends, Daniela and Alicia and myself, we were going, we went for like happy hour sometime in December. It was December 19th. I remember it very clearly because this, we, you know, went for drinks and we were chatting, and I was talking to them after we had finished a meal at Juke, which is like a spot in Chinatown. And we were like wrapping up our dinner together, and I was saying, you know, girls, it's kind of wild. Like, I've been doing therapy, and therapy's just been so incredible for me. Like, I thought that I was going to be focusing so much more on, you know, my assault, but I've spent so much more time talking about my family and myself and family roles and how I see myself in that. Like, I think that I've really processed my assault. Mm-hmm. And you know when you say shit and you put the universe in a position to fucking test you? I felt like that happened, because within like 5 minutes, one of the perpetrators, this man named Ryan, walked in.
Oh.
And he walked in with his friend. And I turned to Dan and Alicia, and I'm like, yo, that's the dude. Like, that's him. And we're sitting at this like long table. My gut is like really churning right now. I'm feeling it. Whew. He sits at a table that's like directly out of my line of sight because the universe is trying to tempt me, but also is like, I got you a little bit. And Alicia's sitting beside me. Actually, Alicia's sitting on the far side of me. And both her and Dan are like, what do you want to do? Like, how do you feel? Because usually in these kinds of situations, Vancouver is such a small city that I've run into both perpetrators so often. Mm. And I usually just remove myself from the situation because it's just like, it's a lot. It's very triggering, especially when you're in close quarters and you're like, I just don't want to have to like lose my shit.
Yeah.
And so I turned to both of them and I'm like, I don't fucking know. I don't know what I want to do, but I need to go to the bathroom because I needed to pee. We'd been like drinking for a couple of hours. So I like went to the bathroom, looked at myself in the mirror, and I was like, girl, what are you going to do? Like, what do you want to do? You know, like I've had so many, I felt like I've had to yield space so many times. And every single time I had done that, I had always felt like I don't even know if the word is like missed the opportunity, but like I felt like I had let myself down in some way, or I felt like I had taken like the easy way out. Again, if you think that survivors are getting like triggered because they're uncomfortable, let me tell you that this shit happens all the fucking time to so many of us.
Yeah.
Okay. So back in the story, I'm looking in the mirror. I'm like, bitch, what are you going to do? And I kid you not, I have been watching so many clips on Instagram of like VH1 shows like Bad Girls Club and Love and Hip Hop New York. And I've seen Cardi B throw glasses of water in men's faces so many times. So anyways, I had this like moment where I like just realized like I need to do something. So I walked out of, you know, the bathroom, and Alicia had our bags ready to go. Like, she was like, okay, escape route, got you. And Daniela was beside me, like she was like at the door, like, hey, what's good? And I just like pull up to this two-top table with Ryan and little homie. And I'm facing him like I'm facing you. And I bend over and I said, are you Ryan? And he said, yeah. And I said, do you remember me? And he said, yes. Oof. And he had this like smirk on his face, you know, like,
yeah.
And so what the fuck did I do? I threw a glass of water in his full on fucking face. Like, I threw a glass of water in his face, right?
Oh my God.
And I'm across the table, like I've fully thrown like his homie's glass of water. And he's like getting all weird and like awkward, you know, when people are embarrassed and start to like laugh. So I just get more and more enraged, right? And so I'm like reaching for the other like glass of water, and Daniela is like, my ride or die. That woman, I love her. So Duke has like vinegar shakers on the table. I kid you not, my bitch, she's like shaking vinegar on this guy. Like, I hope you die of brain cancer. She said that. I'm quoting. That's what she said. And I grab Ryan's glass of water and I throw it in his face and I say, you're fucking disgusting. And I turn to his friend and say, your friend's a fucking rapist. Your friend's a disgusting human being. You don't want to be friends with him.
Yeah.
And at this point in time, like, you know, it's a restaurant. So people are like, what the fuck's this bitch doing? And the, like, you know, kitchen is like peering out of the kitchen, and there's servers, and the bartender behind us is kind of like, what the fuck? So at this point, it's like, I'm like, everyone sees me. I'm like, am I going to be on a world star? I don't know. And Alicia, like another ride or die, is at the door with our bags, like ready to fucking go. And we are like beelining it. This is all within like 20 seconds, right? We're leaving and like exiting, like, you know, Juke. And I'm just like, Ryan is a rapist. You do not want to serve him. He's a disgusting person.
Yes.
You don't want to be friends with him. That guy right over there, he's fucking awful.
And
we bounce.
Oh my God.
And
I love that story so much.
And that's for me, yeah, right? Like, I love that story because I felt like I was like, no amount of hard drugs can get you feeling that in control, that connected
powerful.
To yourself, that powerful, that sense of like owning space.
Yes.
And I was gonna go home, and then both Dan and Leisha were like, bitch, we're going to get a drink to debrief because we need to have a conversation about that. But what that was for me was like the beginning of me, I started to really think about how I wouldn't carry that shame anymore.
Mm.
That shame from my my assault.
Wow.
And there was something so cathartic about literally putting that shame onto Ryan.
Yeah.
Like literally making him feel shame.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, I have had so much to work through.
Yeah.
Now you got to work through some shit, boo-boo.
Oh.
And yeah. One of the things that I really love about just the fact that I did that for myself is that I feel like I hope that I won't have to, if I see him again, I feel like he might walk the opposite direction and be the one to leave and yield space for me.
Yes.
Because I'm that bitch. Yes. I'm that bitch.
Yes.
So.
Oh, thank you for telling that story. I love that story so much. Listening to it, I feel this big energy in me. I feel powerful. Mm-hmm. I feel energized and excited in a way, you know, because what it does for me and what it did for me the first time you told me, it like blew my mind. Honestly, it was like, oh my God, I didn't even consider that something like that was possible.
Yeah.
When I thought of running into these perpetrators, the most I could try to imagine was not completely like shrinking into myself and like running away,
yeah.
like trying to, you know, stand tall and get away was yeah. the most I could imagine. And I didn't know if I'd be able to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
But to hear that story, it's like, there must be there's this whole world of possibilities that I hadn't even started to imagine yet.
Oh, there's a whole world. And I want to say, like, I don't want to ever detract from those survivors who will never feel safe or comfortable enough to approach their perpetrator in yeah. a public place. But for me, I felt like I knew what I had to do for myself. And I finally, for the first time in maybe forever, had the capacity to see things for what they were and know that I had my girls with me. I was safe. I wasn't gonna be victimized by him anymore.
Yeah.
The worst that could happen is that they call me crazy and they kick me out and I get banned. I mean, I'm probably not gonna pull up the Juke anytime soon, just gonna say that.
Yeah.
But you know, and so I thought about all those things and I was like, you know, the odds are that I could probably get away with this. And I wanna also say, like, at the time of after my assault had happened, my volunteer coordinator at this rape crisis center that I was volunteering at, I had told her what happened because that was the only person in my life that I knew had the space and the capacity to really hold my story.
Yeah.
And I told her, like, I don't want to go to the cops. I don't want to, like, file a report, because at that point in time, I was super aware of the facts of, quote unquote, the criminal justice system and how it treats survivors. In Canada, it specifically treats survivors as evidence. So when a crime is committed against anyone, the perpetrator has actually, quote unquote, committed that crime against the Crown. So it wasn't like, it's not like they committed it against me. And I was so aware of the legalese that I just didn't want to wade into that shit. And so what she said to me was, we don't have to go do anything that you don't want to do. We could do anything you want to do.
Mm.
You know, she's like, we can find ways for you to feel safe. We can, yeah. You know, and I think that's where the creativity came from, because the only first person that I talked to about it was like, we don't have to do that shit. I know you don't want to do that shit. That's okay. So I just want to speak to you. There are opportunities. There are ways for us to find our strength or find that release that we need. For me, for a long time, that was doing Muay Thai for a year, just like kicking the shit out of something.
Yeah.
I needed to like expend this energy because I felt like I needed to get my body. I felt like, you know, I was saying my body betrayed me.
Yeah.
You know, there's ways for us to find comfort in our bodies again.
Yeah. Yeah, so for you, the answer to how can I show up for myself in that moment, it was confronting him in that way. And for somebody else, that might not be the answer to that question.
Exactly.
But I think it's just so important for us to center ourselves, to ask ourselves how we want to show up.
Yeah.
And to give ourselves permission.
To do that.
To do that, to take space in whatever way it is mm-hmm. that we need to or that we want to.
Yes.
So I actually want to move into talking about our Women of Color of the Week.
Do it.
We really want to honor Oronike Odeleye and Kenyette Barnes, who founded the Mute R. Kelly movement, as well as Dream Hampton and the rest of the team that produced the documentary Surviving R. Kelly. And the reason I'm bringing this up now is that we had wanted to feature these incredible Black women because they're showing us new possibilities of how we can make change even when things feel impossible. So R. Kelly has been this horrific predator who has been operating in plain sight for decades. And if he could marry a teenager as a grown adult and have the wedding certificate published in the media and be caught on tape raping a 13-year-old and not only not go to jail but actually maintain a thriving music career, it would certainly seem that there's no way to stop him. But these women decided otherwise. So
badass. Just so badass.
Yes. So when an article came out in 2017 detailing a bunch of new allegations against R. Kelly, Orenike decided to do something. So she says, quote, "Someone had to stand up for Black women, and if I wasn't willing to do my part, no matter how small, then I couldn't continue to complain. It's time for us to end this man's career. Enough is beyond enough." So she created
I want to cry just thinking about that. That's so beautiful.
I know. Yeah. So she created the hashtag Mute R. Kelly, which is a campaign to end financial support of his career and to hold him accountable for his violence. And the hashtag started to spread, and then people started protesting his concerts in various cities. And then enter Dream Hampton and the Surviving R. Kelly documentary that aired in January. This was hands down the best documentary I have ever seen on the subject of sexual violence, or really at all. Like, it was
so well done.
Expertly done. Mm. So they talked to so many survivors of R. Kelly. They talked to so many witnesses, so many people who enabled his violence. They talked to experts. This was really key. So anytime a survivor was talking about an aspect of the abuse or the reaction to it that your average person might not understand, they would cut to an expert explaining it.
So they really grounded it in, like, this isn't something that you can discredit or discount.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
Exactly. They covered every base. They supported everything that they did. They covered the dynamics of the violence itself and the culture that supported it. Every single angle of it was covered flawlessly. And the effects of it were stunning. So suddenly we started to see people who had been supporting R. Kelly for decades speaking out against him. Music stations finally started dropping him. Police departments finally started investigating the violence that had been happening in plain sight.
More to come. Chicago PD, you need to get the fucking shit together and, like, finally put this person in jail.
Yeah, there is a lot of reason to believe that he was paying them to look the other way. But I think Chicago PD, as well as Atlanta, as well as, I believe, the FBI have all been investigating him. He's facing various charges in different places. And so the combination of these efforts has been phenomenal. So Surviving R. Kelly has led to him finally being charged for some of his crimes. And then because of Mute R. Kelly, he no longer has the money to buy his way out of it like he's done before. So as the Mute R. Kelly team says, financial boycotts work.
They really work. So shout out to Black women for doing this work, because this harm, and I just want to speak more to the fact that this was happening in plain sight. And we know that. We've always known that. But there's a reason why nobody gave a fuck about it. Yeah. And I want to say it's because his victims were Black women.
Absolutely.
That's and a foundation. Girls. And Black girls.
Yeah.
And Black girls. Let me say that. Black girls. Because there's no amount of dressing a 13-year-old up. There's no amount of sexualizing children that will make them adults. These were children and these were women who were his victims. And they were Black. And that is a huge, huge reason as to why literally nothing has happened.
Well, and very much, I mean, one of the people that they interviewed in the documentary was a juror in his child pornography tape for the rape tape that he made of this 13-year-old. And it was an older white man. And he literally said, because they had, I think it was like 13 witnesses to identify the child in the video and say how old she was and all of that kind of thing. And this juror literally said, "I didn't like those women, so I just discounted everything that they said." He literally said that the reason
he didn't convict was
because he didn't like the way the women, all of the Black women who testified, looked and spoke. And so he literally discounted everything that they said.
So not only are we not being listened to, these people who are having the opportunity to provide us a way of experiencing justice want to deny us that because of who we are.
Yeah.
And also the fact that Black women, women of color, but Black women specifically, are sexualized in such a in a way that disallows us from being victims.
Absolutely.
You know, like, we're not afforded the same kinds of care and nourishment and belief that white women oftentimes are. And the same goes for Indigenous women, and the same goes for Brown women, Black women. Like, racialized women are experiencing these things, and we have to kind of also speak and understand how race plays a really, really, really big role in how some things are considered more serious than other things.
Absolutely.
Or taken more seriously than other things.
Absolutely. And so this is why this is such an incredible example of what we were talking about, that there are so many people and so many systems out there that have no interest in changing. Mm. But what happens when we focus all of our energy on each other, mm-hmm. when we organize and we use our creativity and we persevere, what we can accomplish.
Yes.
So I can't even express how grateful I am to Dreamhampton, Kenyette, Arunike, and everyone else involved in these projects for working to protect Black women and girls from this predator. Bringing down R. Kelly specifically is saving so many lives. Mm-hmm. And more generally, they're showing us what we can accomplish. So it started with Arunike saying, I have to say something. And even if I don't have a platform, even if no one listens, even if he's so much more powerful than I am, right? So it begs the question, what if we all did that? So
yeah.
What if we all looked at what was happening in our little corner of the world and looked at our skills and looked at our values and said, I'm going to do what I can. What could we accomplish?
Mm. And look to the people to our left and to our right who have been telling us what's been happening in their lives and we haven't been listening.
Yeah.
So what can we do? What can be done? We're already doing this work, but what can other people do?
For me, the first thing that I want everybody to do is notice how you feel in your body when the topic of sexual violence comes up. Because I think that a lot of people, some who've experienced sexual violence and some who haven't, are not able to do this work and hold space for survivors and believe and show up because they can't tolerate the feelings that come along with hearing our experiences.
What kind of feelings do you think those are? Like disbelief, like they just couldn't imagine this thing happening, like skepticism, those kinds of feelings, do you think?
Yes, but I think I'm talking more about the ways people get out of their windows of tolerance.
Mm.
I think that a lot of people can't handle intense emotions or intense experiences or hearing about intense experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And there can be a lot of reasons for that. It might not have to do with sexual violence that's happened in their lives, or it might.
Mm.
But there's a lot of reasons why people aren't able to tolerate intensity. I think a lot of people have a lot of shame because they have experienced it, or excuses were made for their perpetrators. And so they've had to make those excuses to hold on to their worldview, to avoid their world being shattered.
Yes.
I think people are afraid of what it would mean if they had to believe that violence was this common and that it was happening all around them in their families and in their workplaces and in their social circles. So I need everybody, whether you've experienced sexual violence or not, we need to do our work.
Yeah.
And that could look like reaching out to a therapist, pandys.org, PANDYS.org. They have a lot of support available online for both survivors and people who love survivors or people in survivors' lives. Local rape crisis centers can help connect you to resources, whether you're a survivor or a supporter. It can look like a lot of things, but we need to be doing our work. And we need to be doing better.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes, to say the least, we need to be doing better.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so I think once we're doing that work, then we actually might get to a place where we can actually listen to survivors.
Mm.
And I think what's really important is it's not just about believing survivors. It's not just saying, okay, this happened to you and I believe you and now we're done.
Yeah.
Until we're living in a world where sexual violence is rare and anyone who does experience it is immediately able to find all the support they need to heal and is really held by their communities and drawn in, we will always have more to learn from listening to survivors. So don't be so arrogant as to think that you have nothing to learn. Like, I've been working with survivors and doing my own healing work for over a decade and I'm still learning.
Mm.
So survivors have so much more to say that it isn't safe for us to say yet. So you need to be making it safe for the people around you and letting people share what they need to share and creating the space for more so that we can keep learning and we can start having more complex conversations because we're really still having one-on-one conversations all the time.
Yeah. I really like that point that you said about if we want to live in a world where these things are so rare, but if they do happen, that there are supports that are readily available.
Yeah.
I feel like that's such an important thing because I felt so alone and I had the resources. Like, that's the thing. Like, I knew that it wasn't my fault. I knew all these things. I had resources and it was still fucking hard,
but
right?
You knew intellectually, but you still felt so much shame.
And like isolation you, and yes, totally.
Like you said it's more reason that you've started to really believe it wasn't your
fault.
Exactly. And that's the case for so many of us. And that's what I mean is that we need the culture to change
mm-hmm.
so that survivors, if somebody does experience this, they don't feel shame because there's no cultural message that it's their fault.
Right. And we still currently live in a world where there is that shame. And so, yeah, that's such an amazing point. Thank you. I think another way that, we can do our work and maybe do better is being aware, paying attention when you're in public spaces, especially for myself. I'm a person who still goes out at night, as in, like, I go to clubs. And like we were talking about earlier, there's a before and there's an after. And in my after, I've been so much more mindful of when I see specifically women or people who look like they identify as women who are too drunk or they're by themselves. I try my best to intervene and ask them, like, if they have friends, like where their friends are. Like, I'm that nosy person. Mm-hmm. I'm that nosy person. And I think it comes from this feeling of we have to be each other's business. Yeah. We have to give a fuck about, like, what's happening to people next to us that we don't really know. I think it's a risk. It's always a risk. And you might find that people are like, get the fuck out of my face. I don't need you. But always, always, always keep your eyes open for those kinds of scenarios, because there are so many predators in these spaces who are literally trying to harm us, who are trying to harm us. They go to these spaces to harm us. And so I think, like I said, there's a before and there's an after. My spidey senses are on. Yeah. And so when you see these things happening, when you see there's a woman who is really drunk and falling all over the place and she's by herself and there are a bunch of other men, just ask her if they're her friends. And if they're not her friends, pretend to be her friend.
Yeah.
You know, like I just think it takes a little bit of creativity and a little bit of just like guts and courage to interject yourself into other people's situations. And you never know whether or not you've been the reason why something didn't go south that night.
Absolutely.
You know? We have to, like, give a fuck about each other, even strangers. And I know that's uncomfortable, especially, I think for me, I'm always thinking about in a city like Vancouver where people are really closed off.
Yeah.
You know? But it's a risk worth taking.
Yeah. And I think we need to be watching the way that we're talking about the things that are happening around us and the things that are happening in the world. Like the Mute R. Kelly founders, I remember them having a post that said, your daughter hears the way you talk about R. Kelly and that's why she won't tell you that her uncle's touching her.
Mm.
Like I said, after it happened to me, I was listening to what people were saying and figuring out what I was supposed to be ashamed of or what was going to make people not believe me. Survivors are around you all the time and we're listening.
Yes.
And so the way you talk about sexual violence, sexual harassment, even dating, hookup culture, all of those things, survivors are listening.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's end with a little checkout.
Yes.
How are you feeling in your body? How are you doing?
I'm feeling good. I'm feeling a lot better. I'm feeling a lot better than before, especially when we were talking. Yeah. Like I'm feeling much more grounded. I'm feeling enthusiastic that we're able to have this conversation.
Yeah.
It feels strange because, like you said before, I can't believe we've never had this conversation. And in preparation for this conversation, we had another conversation because we were like, we don't even really know like where each other is at when it comes to this. We just know that we're both identified as survivors. So it's like, I'm learning so much from you and I'm really grateful for that. And I just want to extend a lot of like love and admiration and extend as much strength as I can give to survivors that are listening. You're so loved and so important and your life is so, it matters so much that I really want you to know no matter what's happened in your life, you are worth being around.
Mm.
You are worth fighting for yourself and fighting for your freedom and fighting for trying to find peace in your body. You know?
Yeah.
That's all I want for us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm really happy we're having this conversation and I feel really good in a lot of ways. I also notice I feel a little activated and my chronic pain's gotten worse in this conversation. So I thought ahead. I brought some peppermint oil. I'm going to put on some peppermint oil, which helps with the pain. And
I'm rub her down. Okay. Well, I'm sorry you're feeling that way.
No, it's okay. It's okay. Thank you. It's okay. But yeah, I'm going to put on that peppermint oil. It's going to help with the pain. It's also grounding with the scent. Mm. And I'm going to just have some water and take a walk around. And I want everyone else to take care of themselves. And we love you.
We do. We really love you.
Yeah.